I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
G'day. How are we all going? Hello, welcome to Sydney Writers Festival 2021. My name is Rick Morton and I'm delighted to welcome you here to today's session and in conversation with the unequaled Don Watson. He's going to hate me for saying that, but he can't talk back just yet. I would like to acknowledge that we are meeting here today on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. They are the traditional custodians of this land, and I pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. And beyond the template line, I do want to say they were our first storytellers, and it is a privilege to, in some small way, I think, follow in their footsteps and to tell stories today on their land. So thank you all for joining us today. I need to introduce Don Watson. He probably needs no words from me, but I will do it nonetheless. Over the past 40 years, Don Watson's essays and reviews on politics, history and culture have appeared in most major Australian journals and newspapers. He is the author of acclaimed bestsellers Recollections of a Bleeding Heart and The Bush, and quarterly essay Enemy Within on the 2016 US presidential election. He has twice won the Age Book of the Year and has also received a Walkley Award, the New South Wales Premier's Award, and the Philip Hodgson's Medal for Australian Literature. His latest book, Watsonia, was published in 2020, and I've been rereading it for this event, and I must say, snort laughing the entire way. Welcome, Don Watson. Please. I thought I might start off with a little bit of history, given your own beginnings in that field, Don. You gave a lecture in 1999 on the subject of Paul Keating, who you called Garibaldi in an Armani suit, which was the first laugh when I read that chapter as well, but there were many more in there. And there's a line in that piece where, you know, discussing the words of John Curtin during the Second World War, when he says that now familiar refrain, you know, Australia looks to America free of any pangs as to our traditional links or kinship with the United Kingdom. And it created outrage then, and again when Keating borrowed the phrase for an Anzac Day address in 1992. But you write of Curtin, he was not discarding our origins, and he knew he needed to acknowledge the past. He needed, in a sense, to bless it before passing on. He also needed to stare it down for the power it had. Now, I think that's true of all our history, not just the key relationships of a nation. But what do you mean by the idea that we need to stare down the power of the past and to bless it?
There's a curious thing about that quote that among those who raged against Paul quoting Curtin was Dame Leonie Kramer, who was a powerful cultural figure on the right in those days, but she was furious with it. But it was obvious he didn't know that they were Curtin's words.
No.
He thought they were Keating's, which seemed to be a bit of a hole in her knowledge. She was otherwise perfect, as we know. I shouldn't speak ill of Dame Leonie Kramer.
I think criticism's allowed.
There was staring down your path. I think there's this strange thing in Australia and in other countries, I think. It's like a bit like Lot's wife. We're frightened of, if we look back, we'll turn to stone or something worse will happen. The whole experiment will fall apart. Whereas it seems to me, so that, you know, in a strange way, the Americans have looked harder at their settler colonial past than we have, mainly through the lens of Hollywood, but elsewhere. You know, they actually celebrate their Indian killers. Davy Crockett, whose song I knew off by heart as a child. Jim Bowie, you know, the Bowie knife, which is an Indian killing knife, is a sort of an icon of American settlement. Kit Carson is a hero. They made TV series about them. Whereas we just like to say, no, it never happened. So we were in denial. For anyone who wrote about it in the 80s and 90s, all those revisionist historians who wrote about it were rendered black armband historians, disqualified. We were to move on at all costs, move on. Don't look back. It's a common Australian attitude, and it's a very practical attitude, but it's the duty of historians to look back. And it seems to me that if you look back and see what actually happened and you have some, you get to know the truth about the past does a couple of useful things. One is that it brings the losers and the victims into the national story, and I think that by doing that, you actually strengthen the social democratic project. You actually strengthen the sinews of the country rather than weakening them. So just as I sort of hold to a kind of broadly social democratic ideal of a society, never perfect, but at least making progress towards justice, then I think, you know, for living contemporary Australians, then I think we should also bring the victims and the losers of the past into the story. And I don't think on the left and among the historians, very often they've got it wrong and they're still getting it wrong. I don't think that simply acknowledging massacres does the trick, but it's a necessary part of it. There's a lot more to it. One of the problems for liberals, it seems to me, is, like myself, is that we tend to call something racist or wrong and feel morally better for it and then move on to something else. And the problem remains unfixed.
Got an almost aesthetic approach to
that's right.
Solving these problems rather than structural.
And it leaves the way open for Bill Leek to draw a racist cartoon, and we all leap around saying, shocking, shocking, shocking. But the cartoon he drew those years ago, actually, if you've been to some of the communities in Australia, they are in horrendous states. I think the story is very complex, and all you're doing by looking back honestly at it is recognising the complexity.
And, you know, even trying to do that now, today, and certainly when you were writing about the culture wars, you know, after your play with Manning Clark, where they kind of almost began, there's this idea, and you make a brilliant analogy in Watsonia and in your past writing, where you liken trying to, you know, be honest about our history to changing the words of a bedtime story of a child. And you write that the child will correct you quite angrily if you're making it up on the fly and they know this story. And this is where you say this is the first flowering of political correctness in its most basic form, that is perhaps what history is. It's much the same with adults and much the same with politics. Don't you dare change the story. How do you do it when that's the overriding, people have put a lot of effort into this. Some people have died trying to prevent us looking back.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's funny with a kid. I mean, you can check if they're listening by changing something in the story, or if they're asleep. You know,
I'll try that with you later on, Don.
That's right. But it's I don't know. I mean, I have trouble with political correctness because I hate political correctness only marginally more than I hate anti-political correctness, and it's. You know, I think the culture wars have been just a calamity. I feel like they've corroded political debate to an appalling extent, and technology seems to have conspired to make them even worse, to multiply them over and over and over again. I think they've ripped the guts out of politics. Political debate is now, it's worse than tribal. Tribal fighting was up close and personal. Now it's from a distance. Hurling rocks and stink bombs at each other across the Gulf, where change actually happens in a society is largely ignored, which is sort of a few degrees to the left and to the right of the centre. The centre is now the radical position, it seems to me.
Well, yes, there's a lot of almost hatred for centrist positions from certain parts of the Australian politic, and I can sort of understand. Perhaps where they're coming from in some senses, which is, what's the centre ever done for us? To butcher that old phrase.
How much time have we got? I mean, there's a great deal of difference between, 3 degrees left of centre and three degrees to the right and 3 degrees to the left. We managed to have absolutely ferocious debates within that arc for a very long time, and change, that's where the change is going to occur. And that is not to say that people shouldn't get out in the streets and take other measures to try and make the centre here. But in the end, that's the only place the change is going to come from. And I think it leaves the way open for the kind of politics we now have in the centre, where we have, you know, marketing mainly and very little policy debate at all.
I'm going to come back to that because I know you've got a particular focus on managerial speak and corporate speak in a post-truth world.
Yes.
but I'm going to get you warmed up first.
Yeah. It doesn't take much.
I'm like a microwave for public conversation. You don't entirely, because I'm trying to figure out where this shift come from, has come from in terms of allowing the culture wars, in terms of, you know, small L liberals ceding ground, and you don't let historians off the hook. In fact, you quite scathingly say to make history boring and irrelevant is a phenomenal achievement and one for which the history profession has to take a lot of credit. But they're not the only ones, and you go on to write, you know, much else conspires to defeat history. A million other stories furiously compete. Narrow vocationalism rules the roost. Training is everything. Economists, who were once safely stowed in cupboards and spoke only at certain times of the year, now run the debates. Our imagination lies elsewhere. I'm a firm believer that economists have a lot to answer for. But what precisely?
Well, I think, you know, it's funny you're quoting that. See, that's probably 20 years ago. And I think the economists have actually drifted a little bit out of the way and made... You know, they're not great at tweeting, I don't think, economists. You know,
that's probably a blessing in disguise for the
time.
Yeah,
I always had trouble getting a sentence out of them anyway, so maybe a text is... But it's true, you know, they only came out at budget time, then you put them back. But they became everywhere. I mean, it was the big picture, was the economic... And they're important people, and some of them are better than others. But... you know, if you were setting up a few stocks in Martin Place, you know, you'd probably have one for economists, one for architects, a few for developers.
A couple for journalists, no doubt.
Casino operators and so on. But what do we blame? Well, you see, there was this, in our own time, the zealotry of neoliberal economists was horrendous. Mind you, I think the most zealous of them all in those days was John Hewson, for which I think Labor should be very grateful. So I think he gave them another 3 years. And there was a sort of... They used to drive me mad a bit because they were like Bolsheviks. You know, there was a sort of ideological purity, and you had to be very careful in any debate you were having with them that you didn't step into an area where you would be forever cast as wrong,
yes.
As a Whitlamite or something, someone who wanted, you know, the unemployed to be doing roundabouts and smoking dope or something like that. So you always had to have the debate five times and say, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we have 10% unemployed and we ought to do something about it. It really was, and there were some there, I wouldn't mention names, who I think had the debate continued on that level, we would have ended up rather like, you know, you wouldn't have got a bullet behind the ear, but it had something similar to that, and you'd be purged and so on. It was a combination of economics and ideology, I suppose. I mean, we're really talking about Thatcherite thinking. And I think, you know, that leads on to the fact that, you know, the universities are now, if you take Sydney and Melbourne University, they're massively rich places. Melbourne University has bought most of Carlton.
Yes.
the whole tram routes have been changed. Everything, you know, God knows, it's worth more than the GDP of several African nations, probably. But there's very little one-on-one lecturing and tutoring. The whole humanities departments have disappeared, where this government is actually very keen on removing arts and humanities from the liberal arts are fading away from these places.
There's a reason for that, surely.
It's an economic reason, if you like to call it economic. I think it's a disaster. And fits very strangely with the idea of a meritocracy. You know, you believe in a meritocracy and you run education down. That's curious, isn't it, really?
Well, it depends what they define as merit, really, isn't it?
Well, it depends what a meritocracy actually is. That's the thing.
Do you have a view on that? What a meritocracy would actually look like? I know that...
It looks like this.
Yeah.
It looks like Britain. it looks like the United States. You know, someone made the absolutely incisive remark about meritocracy that at least in a feudal system, if you were poor and deprived, it wasn't your fault.
I was going to, that was one of my favourite quotes from this whole collection. Because that's, you know, right now, of course, it's always our fault. It's a moral problem of the poor, that they're poor.
Well, it's the justifying narrative of neoliberalism. You know, the people, you know, get there by merit. You see, Jamie Packer, it was all merit. Gina Reinhart, merit. You know, she worked her way up. She worked her way up the ladder. There was no room for anybody else, but she got up there. And the funny thing is about the meritocratic ladder is that there's no room for anyone to come down. No. So if you get there, you jump. Or you just stay there and you bring your sons and daughters up, you know, mainly your sons. You throw them down a rope and pull them up. You know.
One by one. Just like an elaborate rope and pulley system.
That's
for
right.
Advancement.
No, I think it's a total nonsense. And I mean, there are AOs up the top and AMs and all those things we put up there. I don't know whether they're worth a lot these days, but...
No, they seem to have been infiltrated from within in at least some quarters.
I'd bring back knighthoods myself. Make it worth something, you know, really.
One label you do appear to dislike, and that has caused you some embarrassment, is public intellectual. Is that worse than an AO?
Well, I went to America for a while in about 2005, and when I came back, somebody had conducted a survey of, I don't know how they'd done it, but they decided, they had a list of Australia's leading public intellectuals. Rob Mann was at the top. I'm not going to argue with any of this. But what was more alarming was that I was number 13. I mean, which is just ludicrous. And there are some really clever people in the world. And to think that I was number 13 as a public intellectual is just idiotic.
What does that say about the system of ranking?
Well, it says it's just a nonsense. I mean, somebody on an American radio station asked me what a public intellectual was. It was on the back of the book, in the American edition of the book, to my horror. And he was a hard right interviewer in Denver. And I said, I could only think to say, well, I suppose you are. You know? You're telling all these people what to think every day, you know, you've got it all at your fingertips. You've got, anyway, shut him up. I don't know if you know any further. But, you know, when you think... I mean, Peter Doherty wasn't in among the public intellectuals. But, you know, I don't know what it means. It means you've got to have a university degree and you don't write in the newspapers unless it's on an op-ed, you know. Something. No journalist can be a public intellectual. So.
Probably for the best.
Yeah. I don't know. It just seems to me just another little bit of nonsense that floats around in the world.
Bit of flotsam. I want to take you back a little bit to where you began your life, at least, in the Gippsland region of Victoria. And you were writing as an introduction to Laurie Dugan's 1987, The Ash Range. You wrote an introduction and you said, you know, there was a whole pages and pages, actually, of, you know, different ways to dispatch snakes. And the fact that, as you write, we told jokes about snakes and played jokes with dead ones. And then you say, long into the nights, we yarned about them. Deep in the Gippsland subconscious, there lay a coiled snake. Had it been a Catholic province, I believe there would have been an annual festival. Now, I grew up in outback Queensland, and I can confirm the accuracy of that statement. But what is it that you mean by this idea that there's a coiled snake at the conscious? I think it's true for most regional areas as well.
And for our Prime Minister, the evil one.
Don't tread on me.
Well, there you are. Well, they were very powerful. I don't know what it is about snakes. I don't know why we have this terrible fear of them, but they were... There was nothing... I don't think we talked about anything, with the possible exception of biscuits, as much as snakes. We talked about snakes far more than we talked about the cows and the chooks or anything else.
Even the weather.
You know, did you see any snakes? I saw a snake. I think I saw a snake. What was it? Tiger? Copperhead? Black snake? So on. It was a huge subject. And I mean, they were nothing compared to your snakes.
Yeah. Thank you. It's one of the small victories in my life, Don.
King Browns and taipans and things you have up there, but I don't know where they fit. It's a curious thing, but if you can read the entire journals of John McDougall Stewart or Sturt or Mitchell, they never mention snakes. I mean, they must have been stepping on them all the time. But Stewart, you know, went 5 or 6 times backwards and forwards trying to get to the north coast of Australia. He never saw a snake.
That had never occurred to me, but that's an astonishing insight.
I read on thinking, where's the snake? No, not a mention. And there were death adders out there in his path, and maybe he just trod on them and wore big boots and didn't even notice they were there. But he was only a little bloke, Stewart, so I don't know.
I like that you've taken me down this path, because you were writing in Meanjin in 1986, and all of these things, by the way, are in Watsonia. It's where I'm getting these collections from, in a piece called The Joke After God. And you're lamenting the fact that, you know, a certain version of Australian rural humour is no longer understood or is on the way out. And the definition of Australian rural humour that you make is, defeat is the essence of this Australian rural humour. It is nature mocking our intentions. And then you add, in the Australian bush, God was a satirist, which I love. And I think that so perfectly encapsulates why it is that, you know, the irony, I guess, of us against the elements.
Yeah, well, I think there's nothing. I mean, I think the essence of humour, for me anyway, is really a man wrestling with a stump, trying to get down to the ground. I mean, this thing that just won't move and your wrestling just looks ridiculous. It won't. And from that flow a whole lot of other jokes, you know, which, you know, Lawson and Patterson made much of, and George Wallace later on, and so on. I do remember coming over a hill one day and seeing my football coach, a farmer, a very, you know, metal laconic farmer, sitting looking at a stump and rolling another cigarette. And I asked him what was going on. He said he'd put a charge under the stump to blow it out of the ground. And it hadn't gone off. And he was just having another smoke, wondering whether at what point he could safely approach the stump and attach another fuse. And I don't know, he may have been there for a week. I have no idea. He might have camped, but an awful lot of rural humour flowed from that sort of situation. And I read on a selection again about 2 years ago and found I laughed as much as I did when I was a kid reading it. And that's, of course, a Queensland story. But we got a lot out of on a selection because the pathos and the humour combined, and the sort of this... God is never mentioned in on our selection, but he's there all the time. This utterly, this cruel and unknowable force that would ruin your corn crop, or, you know, bring a plague of kangaroos, or do something to you. And even the illustrations, the Fullwood's illustrations were. Reminded me of my grandfather standing up and banging the table and saying, "Get out of here!" You know, it was full of an Old Testament sort of world.
Yeah, and I guess in kind of contrast to that, you write in the same essay towards the end that, you know, there's no going back now. You know, those hippie literati will not find a sense of humour hobby farming on the south coast, which is a funny sentence, but it also contains quite a nugget of truth, right? It's a contest.
I think that's right. I went to Nimbin a few years ago, and you know,
what for, do you mind my asking?
Just to see it, and I thought it was incredibly sad. Not just for what the, you know, it was not a good advertisement for the hallucinogens. But you know, buried under Nimbin was a sort of dairy farming community, you know, of great aspirations and lost hopes and. You know, the old war memorial sitting there, ignored, painted in rainbow colours, no doubt.
Yes.
And there just seemed to be a certain provenance that was sadly lacking now. So I miss a lot of that stuff. I think, in some ways, I'm a sort of Tory, I think. You know, I like things that last. I don't see we ought to get rid of them necessarily.
Yes, but, you know, Tories want certain things to last, and, you know, I prefer steam engines to last and toasters. And microwaves, but not necessarily, you know, neoliberalism.
No. That's right. But neoliberalism wants to cast everything aside, and I mean, you know, often the left want to do the same thing. I think we need a certain amount of permanence and things which reference the past. I think there's a real human instinct to get rid of it because it's painful.
Mm.
You know, I've always had this thing: if you drive past an old country house or something, it just sets up a spasm of melancholia that, you know, lasts you for another 20 miles.
Yes, which is, and I was going to ask you about this, but that's a very Freudian concept, right? And you actually mentioned Freud quite a lot in your writing. I might get this wrong, and you can correct me, but he said that a fallen down or dilapidated house is a sign of, you know, great grief or.
Yeah, well, I think that's what it is. I mean, you imagine children once played there and people had grand hopes and all sorts of things, and it's a powerful thing. I think I got onto it before Freud, actually. I think it sort of happened. I've read some Freud, I wouldn't call myself a Freudian in a fit, but I think when you write about these sorts of things, you need to sort of, you know, pick away at the scabs of your own consciousness a bit and examine what things generate feelings. And I like essays that do that sort of thing, that really examine your own reactions and so on. So I tend to poke those sorts of things into essays. Not as well as great essayists do. I was reading Zadie Smith's, those little essays she wrote last year, which are just fabulous things.
Wow.
They make you want to give up, really.
I mean, you are pretty tough on yourself as a writer throughout this collection, but, you know...
You don't want to get a big head in this, in anything at all, as my mother used to say.
Do you think I feel like in your writing, at least, you've escaped that. Because you don't call it modesty, because it's not false, it's not calculated modesty, it's just that you think there are better writers.
Well, there are, you know, there are, you know, God. There really are, that's all that can be said.
You know, in this kind of address to the Authors Society in 2013, Prometheus with a Pen, you kind of touched on something that I relate to quite strongly, because we come from similar backgrounds at least. And you say that you've never been comfortable as a writer, and it might have something to do with coming from among people for whom writing was a dubious profession, not a serious thing to be doing with one's life, a stupid sort of thing to do with it, in fact. And you say that maybe once you're subjected to that sort of conditioning, we never entirely escape its effects.
No, I think that's right. I think... I think one's analyst would probably say it's the inner critic that you never once planted in you never get rid of. And it can be a good thing. It probably gets a bit harsh. You're sort of fighting it all the time, not to think that you should pack it in and go back to milking cows. But it's... I think probably a lot of writers struggle with the same thing, and I think the longer you do write, the more fierce your self-criticism becomes. You know, you realise how much there is in the amount of possibility in any writing is limitless. You know, it's a bit like, you know, the way the old jazz musicians used to talk about improvisation. They'd say, well, you can never play the same piece of music twice the same, so why not just improvise all the time? You know, it'll always come out different. And you know that if you write, you know, if you write three or four paragraphs one morning and you lose them. The heartbreaking thing is you know you can't write them again. It won't come out the same. There'll be a shift of meaning. Now, the other thing is simply that there are some people who are really great writers, and some of us just do the best we can, and that's the way it is. I don't think I'm dedicated enough to be a great writer, that's the thing. I like horse racing too much.
I mean, there is a preoccupation in some of your work about this idea that you might have wasted part of your life
Wasted a huge
not
part
writing
of it.
Enough for
no
or in politics?
My tombstone should read, he never did his best. No, I think we do. I think we all probably waste a huge amount of life. That's why I sort of struggle with the idea of meritocracy. I think, you know, meritocracy is partly, you know, based on IQ and the other part is on effort now. You know, we've all got to try our hardest. And you can be whatever you like, dream the impossible dream, climb every mountain. Whatever you want to be, you can be, which is total bullshit. You know, it's absolute. And no one should be allowed to say it at a speech night anywhere in the country, you know. It's just so utterly unfair, you know.
Well, I was going to say, I think you make the point saying, you know, you try saying live in the moment to a kid in a refugee camp in Darfur.
Exactly. I mean, that's the moment you don't want to live in. You want to have an imagination to escape that moment, you know.
And it's the basis for a lot of trauma as well. It's the whole point of getting you out of your body when bad things happen.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think there's all that kind of, you know, not to be taken seriously. I don't know about the... I can't even remember where we were up to. Where were we?
Well,
I was just getting angry.
Well, look, I mean, you angry is like watching a wounded eagle try and land. It's still beautiful, I think. Yes.
We'll go now.
Sorry, I was trying to maintain my professionalism. You actually gave a speech to some Monash students in 2010 where I think some of these concepts came up. But the part that really grabbed my attention, I love when we get to subjects like this, you're talking about human beings as a species and you say, here's a funny thing. We human beings are not very strong. Gorillas, I think, are 10 times stronger. We're not very fast. A kelpie is much faster and a kelpie has a far better sense of smell. We don't climb very well. We can't fly. We're ungainly in the water compared to fish or platypus and we can't breathe under it. We're hopeless burrowers. Our domination of the world is consequent entirely on our brains. Yet most of us will do almost anything to avoid using them. Have you seen what's on cable television? Now, I've always been pretty good at digging a burrow, but I think there's something there.
But
in this,
have
right?
you seen a wombat? I mean, it's just...
We raced. What, I mean... Obviously, I mean, it's very easy sometimes to slip into this idea of, like, looking down on the masses and, you know, people in suburbia and whatnot, but that's not what you're doing. You're just saying this brain is a gift, right?
Yeah. And it's also a curse. I mean, if you see... a few weeks ago, I saw a day-old goat, and it was leaping about. I mean, it was fully formed. The brain was working as well as it's ever going to work, and it was completely happy playing games, doing all sorts of things. A horse, all these animals, we take so long to develop. I mean, everyone knows this. Our brains take so long to develop that we've got a massive neuroses by the time we're able to, you know, finish school. And we'd struggle with them for the rest of our lives. I mean, it is a curse, but it's also true. I mean, to put the, I think, the you know, a bit of a gloss on this, the thing is, we're not, this is again why the meritocracy is such a crazy idea. I mean, there's a huge amount of pleasure to be got in life simply from thinking nothing. You know, one of the things about walking with things in your ears or a phone or whatever, as people now do, taking it with them wherever they go, is that they're not only they're not thinking about big questions or little ones, they're just taking in rather than having their brains empty for a while. You know, most of the great pleasures of my life have just been observing, just watching, experiencing, you know, and the idea that we should be constantly using our brains is crazy. On the other hand, we should use them as much as we can for whatever purposes. But against the idea of using our brains, we're swamped with bullshit, you know, basically. We just see this stuff coming towards you. If you're not aware of it when you're at home, you are when you stay in a hotel for a couple of nights. And you, for some reason, in a hotel, you touch on the TV, which you'd never do normally, and then you just see what's really what people are taking in. And it's utterly vacuous.
Yes.
You know? And so what I was trying to tell those young people, I suppose, was to just, my point would really be not only use your brains, but use it to observe and to enjoy, you know. Go and look at things, which they don't do.
No, not often enough anyhow, myself included, unfortunately. Of course, when you do use your brain, you turn it to some wicked effect sometimes. And I must say my favourite moment, I guess, and I haven't read everything you've ever written, but I've read most, I think. And my favourite moment in your entire writing career, I think, is when you're talking about, well, you're actually skewering this idea of mateship that it keeps getting invoked in Australia. And of course, you know, there's quite this one bloke who's returned, I think, from the First World War, where he says, alas, you know, because there was no women around, it was just men. And alas, the sin for which God destroyed the doomed cities was present, which is homosexuality for those playing along at home. And you say that the idea that there is something homosexual about mateship is a familiar sacrilege that we need not entertain. But we do need to recognise that the meaning of the word mateship is plainest when it describes the attachments and needs of men struggling in a common cause. And this is one of the best lines I think I've ever read in the English language. In simple terms, while mateship might justly be applied to relations between shearers or miners during a strike or lockout, it is a corruption in a day spa.
That's not bad.
See, you're not bad. You're not bad. I chose that for effect because it's a funny line. But you are more not just mateship, but this idea of Anzac spirit as well, and also corporate jargon. This is what's bad about the English language, right? When we say things that don't actually mean anything.
Yeah. Well, on mateship, I don't know how this mateship thing keeps going, frankly. I mean, more than 50% of the population are women, and mateship, you can try and make it mateship something that applies to the whole population. It doesn't work. It's a men's thing. It's the sort of intellectual men's shed. That's where they go to amuse themselves in whatever way they like, yeah. You know. And I think for, you know, some people sort of chose mateship, but most of us had mateship thrust upon us, as it were. And we don't want it. I don't want it. I mean, the only use of mateship I can ever find is as you get older and you can't remember people's names, mate. Yeah. Mate sort of helps. But I still don't like using it when I forget women's names, you know. I just can't bring myself, it's just old-fashioned, I suppose, mate. But no, I think, you know, and I think it's also, again, you know, this idea that we should be aiming high in everything. And doing our very best. Mateship is the reverse of that. Mateship obliges us to slum if necessary. You know, you stick by a mate. Well, if your mate is a criminal or a dumkopf, or do you keep sticking by him? Do you say, oh no, I won't do what I ought to be doing, I'll stick by my mate? I mean, it's a dumb idea. Besides, a friendship is done for the human species for a very long time, you know. Having friends is surely enough. Why do we have to turn it into a religion, a cult, you know, a cult of friendship? How stupid is that? You just have friends.
I think you made the point that if left to their own devices, you're confident that even the Europeans could discover the concept.
Yeah, they could probably understand friendship eventually, you know. You would think, you know, particularly when it's applied to when it takes on a military sort of meaning, that it becomes, you know, you would think that only Australian soldiers could sleep safely in a trench without being stabbed by others, you know, by their bayonets. You know, that in other countries people are always killing each other for no reason at all because they don't understand mateship. And betrayal is a way of life, you know, I think we should get rid of that one as quickly as we possibly can. What was the other? Well, Anzac.
Mm.
I don't know.
Which is slightly different, although, I mean.
I think if you go to the war memorial now, I went about 18 months ago, and they had managed to turn, I think, the best memorial in the country, a somber secular memorial to the soldiers. Not to anything more but the soldiers, a point of remembrance. And they had made it a noisy piece of kitsch. And now they're doing even more to it. I mean, it was an absolute disgrace. It was mayhem in there. And, you know, armaments manufacturers sponsoring halls and maybe tanks and all sorts of things around the place. Completely ruined what was the most perfect thing. And remembering that it was actually for the soldiers. It wasn't to represent some other kind of national goal or anything. It was a beautiful thing, as they all were. They were all secular memorials, the one up in Hyde Park, the one in Melbourne town. But they destroyed it. And Brendan Nelson, more stocks in Martin Place, one for...
I mean, $500 million, and yet the National Archives can't archive everything. I mean, exactly. I think that's your point about history right there, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, they're going to pull down half of it and build this massive... But, you know, I think this is the problem with Anzac Day has become a kind of a sort of religion for Australia, the official state religion. Anzac was, I think people growing up believing that Australians were pretty well the only ones who fought, and they won both wars single-handedly. that they were quite incapable of doing anything wrong on the battlefield or anywhere else. This is contrary to what we know. They were soldiers and...
Well, human beings.
You know, if you read Marcel Bloch, the French historian who fought in both wars and was executed by the Nazis in 1944, Bloch wrote about being a captain in a regiment in the First World War, and it was all for the soldiers, for the battalions. And that's how, when you talk to vets, their attachment is to the battalion. They want to be recognised, and they did their, you know, and they should be looked after in every way. But we take it out into this other kind of realm, which I think is poisonous to the country. And again, it's looking back at history and turning it into a kind of convenient narrative rather than a truthful one.
Yeah, or even a theme park as opposed to what actually happened, like the War Memorial.
It's also where the Australian story became decisively and forever a men's story. The First World War. Women were pushed aside as they'd been pushed aside in the bulletin and all the way up there. Once the First World War was over, Australia became a men's place.
And yeah, we've seen the consequences of that recently. I am aware of the time, and I will get to audience questions very shortly, but I did just want to quickly, I've got so many things I want to ask about, but I do want to touch on the Republic, given it has been the idea of a Republic and separating from our mothers over in the United Kingdom. And again, I'm going to a fun line, but you talk about the fact that, you know, the Queen, you know, wouldn't have been selected perhaps under a meritocracy, but she's actually the best candidate in the monarchy in at least one piece. And then you say when the time comes, you know, when she eventually passes or dies, because I know how much you probably hate the word passes.
I hate passing.
Yes. And when he finally ascends, who is going to kneecap poor old Charles, that gentle democratic socialist and organic farmer? Mm. That's the predicament of the Republic right there, isn't it? Is it?
Well, it is a problem. I mean, it is curious about the Queen. If you've got the biggest headhunters in the world in 1953 to choose the Queen, the next Queen of England, they couldn't have done anywhere near as well as they did by just heredity.
But, you know, the exception does not prove the rule.
No, I know. Yes, that's true. But, I was a sort of fervent Republican in the 1990s, and I probably still think it's a better idea, but I think the response to Philip's death was so extreme. I mean, they actually took Vera off and didn't bring it back on that night. Which shows, anyone who reckons the ABC is this sort of left-wing, terrible sort of, you know, at 1 o'clock they were still showing bits of Philip going up and down, you know, in his prime. Vera never came on again.
No, no.
And I have, I don't know how, I think it might be just something that's immovable. You know, it'll have to collapse of its own accord before we get rid of it. And I mean, it's going to be terribly hard to jettison Charles, because he's been such a sad bloke and he's waited for so long. And finally that sort of cruel superego is in the ground and he's on his own, but Mum's still going. I feel for him. We were born about the same time and I feel our lives, we've lived in parallel, really.
That's just about done me. I am going to... look, so I'm going to ask, if you want to ask a question, and I can happily keep going if you don't.
Keep asking questions.
Look, I'm happy to. Great. Even better. That was very easy. Well, in which case, let's continue on the monarchy republican theme, because one of the symptoms, I guess, or causes of our inability to detach, it seems, is this kind of ongoing, I guess, we think we're a young nation, you say, but we're actually quite elderly. And I just want to find that quote now, because there's a great line where you say, this seems to me both a symptom and a cause of our endemic elderliness, this need to identify with the parent culture, this desire to imitate it. And it's another way in which we're old. We've been clogged up since birth with elderliness. For generations, we were governed by people, men mainly, who were culturally conditioned to age prematurely. They're still around. You can see it in the young liberals.
That's true.
Expand.
Well, it's funny, you could sit in the cafeteria in the Parliament House in 1993 or thereabouts, and you could tell the tables with young lips by their haircuts. They had haircuts like their dads. And I've always thought that they, you know, this was the sort of essential difference between people, that between men, you know, some are born, and all they want to do from the moment they're born is be like their dads. Somehow the Oedipal reflex fails, you know. And the left sort of rebel and play up and take drugs or something and fight with their fathers and go through a mad period, but I think it's a necessary period for 10 or 12 years. It's funny, you know, Tolstoy did, Flaubert did, all the people did that. And then they become ferocious defenders of their fathers later on in life. It's a very common theme of men's literature, really. There's this rebellion and the shame and then the...
This is really just, it's not a book, it's a letter to my father kind of thing.
That's right.
My entire career, unfortunately, as a writer, but at least yeah. I'm not alone.
I think it's very common. And but where did that question start? We ended with the young lives.
We're quite old, as it? We
yeah,
think
well,
we're young,
we are.
But we're
I mean,
so
democracy
attached.
Democracy is very old. I mean, the colonies had early forms of democracy in the 1850s and 60s. And even the Federation, we predate... a lot of countries with democracy, universal suffrage, and so on. But I think for a long while, because of that sort of British connection, authority sort of stemmed from this elderliness, you know, that we are, you know, young as we may be, we were nevertheless somehow connected to Britain, and that gave us a spine, in a way, and a framework for life. And it was very powerful way into the 1950s and 1960s when I was a kid, you know. And it always sat in a strange relationship to what was naturally occurring to us, you know, that the country was growing its own history. And you know, it's an odd thing, you know, that in the 1930s we were ferociously patriotic to the Brits. We were determined to pay back what we owed them, even though we'd lost 60,000 men in the war. We were still determined to pay back our loans and to Jack, as Jack Lang found to his cost. When the crisis with the monarchy fell, Menzies actually, they closed down the radio. There would be no broadcast because of the crisis in the British monarchy in 1937, whatever.
It's almost as bad as taking Vera off.
It was very similar, very similar. And I think Vera's been going for that long too. May she keep going. But at the same time, people were listening to Roy Rean, this bizarre comedian. Who they loved, who could only have grown out of Sydney, basically, or George Wallace, who were just, you know, they were listening to, they were reciting Paterson and Lawson. So we had this sort of split in our brains. But I think, you know, that Britain remained the sort of, you know, the comforter, the transitional object to which we clung. And I think probably without, you know, being too dramatic about it, I have a feeling that right now we're at a point where the transitional object is being taken away from us. you know, the soft toy is being removed, and we're, it's funny how we're reacting. Maurice Payne is taking us into another world.
Do you think the human embodiment of this entire concept of, you know, the blankie, is it Tony Abbott, do you think? Because there's an amazing point in this book where, in contrast, you're writing about Malcolm Turnbull, but you write that even if he's obliged to deny his own belief and make the case for reactionary causes against which he has defined himself and devoted part of his life to overthrowing, and this is where Tony Abbott comes in, not by name, and must appease the authors of them, even if he has inherited the rubble of his predecessor, and even if he knows that he will be stalked forever by the revenant, Grim and Rictus, himself his own dungeon, keeping his wound green and feeding his thirst for retribution. I
wish Tony was back. It was so good.
I didn't want to spend too long on modern politics, but I wanted to ask you about that. We knew what Tony was. What is Scott Morrison? More than one word answers, obviously.
I think he's the man for our times. You know, he is the ultimate marketer. It's funny, if you scan the Australian papers on your screen or wherever you go, his picture is just everywhere. Absolutely. He's always there, which is exactly, it was Trump's lesson. It doesn't matter what you say, it can be the most outrageous. So long as you're the news, that's what will get you re-elected. And that's what will keep your popularity up. You can't put Scott Morrison down too much so long as he's rating at 60%. And so long as... Look, I don't know. I didn't think we'd ever have an evangelical running the show. A man who believes in, well, I suppose the evil one. It's a concrete expression of what, you know, of bad things. I don't know. We have fallen back into his arms, and he hasn't dropped us.
How?
It seems.
Mm.
But it turns me off politics. I'd rather be. It does certainly push me further and further towards horse racing. I can't.
Which one's more cruel?
But this is the crazy thing about. I mean, this is the thing about politics. I don't know anyone here. Maybe someone here could name a policy that has been talked about in any kind of serious way for the last 6 months. Year, I think it's incredibly hard to think of some policy initiative that is in the public mind. It is not there. And then the other night I watched, there is Scott Morrison spinning, his wheels spinning like this, and so are our brains. And there's poor old Elbow up outside Uluru with a big hat on, no doubt five advisors somewhere to the left and right of him, and no one had given him the air guard. Not one of them. There'd be $500,000 worth of salaries among his genius advisors, and no one had given him a bit of a spray. So everyone watching that saw Albanese trying to get these damn flies off his face, and no one has a clue what he said because they were watching the flies.
That's a lesson for us all, I think, right?
It is. Remember the air guard.
Yes. Yeah. Look, I think we're almost exactly on time for the end. We are, actually. So thank you so much. That was so far the privilege of my career, getting to talk to you on stage, Don Watson.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.